Good evening. Job growth takes a hit. African Americans and mental health discussed in Congress, and magic mushrooms are legal in Denver and Oakland. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, June 7th, 2019. An appeals court has lifted a judge's injunction that blocked construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada to the U.S., but the developer has said it's too late to begin work this year, and environmental groups vowed to keep fighting it. A three-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on Thursday ordered dismissal of the lawsuit by environmental and Native American groups, saying President Donald Trump had revoked a 2017 permit allowing the $8 billion pipeline to be built. Trump later issued a new permit, and the appellate judges agreed with Justice Department attorneys who say that nullifies the legal challenge involving environmental impacts. The pipeline would ship up to 830,000 barrels of crude oil daily from the tar sands of Alberta through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska, where it would tie into existing pipelines to carry the crude to U.S. refineries. Attorney Stephen Volker, who represented the Indigenous Environmental Network and North Coast River Alliance, said he would request another judge's order to block the project if he thought there was a chance of construction beginning immediately. Representatives of a half dozen other environmental groups vowed to keep fighting in court and predicted the pipeline will never be built. U.S. job growth slowed sharply in May and wages rose less than expected, raising fears that a loss of momentum in economic activity could be spreading to the labor market, which could put pressure on the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates this year. The broad cool-off in hiring reported by the Labor Department on Friday was before a recent escalation in trade tensions between the United States and two of its major trading partners, China and Mexico. Trump, who has routinely tweeted about the strong labor market, made no comment about May's weak hiring, but defended duties on Chinese goods. But U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, said the employment report was a disturbing sign that the administration's disastrous special interest agenda is hollowing out our economy. The unemployment rate remained near a 50-year low of 3.6% in May. The U.S. House Oversight Committee plans to vote next week on holding Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt of Congress for stonewalling a probe into an alleged scheme to politicize the 2020 U.S. Census. On Friday, the committee's majority Democrats released a memo alleging that the White House interfered directly and aggressively with an attempt by the panel to interview Chris Kobach, a former Kansas Secretary of State, about a plan by President Donald Trump's administration to add a question on citizenship to next year's U.S. Census questionnaire. A committee announcement said the contempt vote would initiate civil litigation to force compliance with its subpoena. And a New York man who prosecutors say plotted an attack on Times Square spoke about killing police officers and praised Islamic militants appeared in court on firearms charges on Friday and was denied bail. Federal officials said Ashiki Alam, 22, from Jackson Heights in the city's Queens Borough, was charged with illegally acquiring firearms as part of the attack plan. According to a complaint unsealed on Friday in Brooklyn Federal Court, Alam was arrested on Thursday after receiving two Glock 9 millimeter semi-automatic pistols with their serial numbers stripped off from undercover law enforcement officers. In Washington, D.C. today, award-winning actress Taraji P. Henson spoke candidly about mental health issues affecting youth in the African-American community at a congressional hearing on Friday. She said, "I'm here to appeal to you because this is a national crisis."
It dawned on me the reason why we don't have many psychiatrists, not that we don't have them, that they're not easily accessible, is because we in the African American community, we don't deal with mental health issues. We don't even talk about it. We've been taught to pray our problems away. We've been demonized for coming out saying we have issues, and we have trust issues. I need the person sitting opposite from me when I go seek help for my mental to be culturally competent. And if you're not culturally competent, how can I trust you with my deepest secrets and with my vulnerability? So this foundation was founded, like I said, out of a necessity. I also, before becoming a successful actress, I was a substitute teacher. I opted to teach special education children. When I got my credentials and I started to go out into the world and sub, I got sent to Crenshaw, and I thought I was going to a school for special needs kids. And when I got there, I was in a room full of all black young males labeled special ed. None of them were in wheelchairs. They could all speak. They could walk. They had all of their facilities. As I stayed in the school, I started talking to the young men. Of course, I started finding out that they were going home to parents, no parents being home. One kid was found walking along the train tracks, wandering, no parents at home. One kid was arrested for stealing, just merely wanted to eat, needed something to eat because there were no parents at home. At a 7-Eleven, he was got caught stealing. Just things were not right with me. I just, that sat with me and it bothered me because I'm raising a young black man. And when I proceeded to try and teach these young men, they believe this label that had been placed upon them. I'm special ed, Ms. Henson, I can't learn that. Another thing that bothered me was children normalizing shootouts. I got to school another day, and kids are grabbing me by the hand, and they're going, "Ms. Henson, look, there was a shootout last night," pointing to the bullet holes in the walls of their school, laughing. We're expecting these children to come from traumatic experiences at home, and we're expecting them to go to school and learn, and it's just not fair. We can't give up on our kids, and I think that's where it starts. I think we implement mental illness or mental health as education in school. It needs to be a subject, just like sex education was, a physical education. We need to talk about it. The more we talk about it, the more people will feel like they can talk about it. I really don't know how to fix this problem. I just know that this suicide rate is rising. I just know the ages of the children that are committing suicide are getting younger and younger. It breaks my heart to know that 5-year-old children are contemplating life and death. That one is tough for me. So I'm here to appeal to you because this is a national crisis. When I hear of kids going into bathrooms cutting themselves, you're supposed to feel safe at school. I'm here using my celebrity, using my voice to put a face to this, because I also suffer from depression and anxiety. And if you're a human living in today's world, I don't know how you're not suffering in any way. I mean, if you turn on the news, that's PTSD right there. We need each other. This is me reaching across the table, trying to lend a helping hand in the best way I can. We have to save our children.
In April, the Congressional Black Caucus launched a task force on mental health issues facing black teenagers. Every year, 1 in 5 adults in the U.S. experience a mental illness, but a National Alliance on Mental Illness study found that 60% didn't receive treatment and that black adults use mental health services at half the rate of white adults. Among high school students, black teens are more likely to attempt suicide than their non-Hispanic white counterparts at a rate of 8.9% compared to 6.8%. Before Henson became an actress, she worked as a special education teacher. She said the survival of children is at stake.
I'm noticing a rise in children, also freshmen, going off to college, having serious coping issues. They are having psychotic breaks. This one is a little personal, I'm sorry. But they're having psychotic breaks because they don't feel included, or they're, you know, it's the damage of social media. And we have to turn this boat around or we're going to lose humanity. And it starts with the kids. We need to focus on our children now.
Award-winning actress Taraji P. Henson speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus hearing on suicide and mental health. Henson's father, a Vietnam veteran, suffered mental health issues until his death in 2006. And climate change is affecting New York, a coastal city built on huge expanses of reclaimed marshland. After Superstorm Sandy, plans were begun to involve residents in desperately needed flood prevention or resiliency plans. The result was the East Side Coastal Resiliency Project, what the city calls an integrated coastal protection system that will reduce the risk of flooding. The problem, the city's plan made public last year, was totally opposite the plan residents had participated in drawing up during the previous 4 years. At a public meeting held on the Lower East Side last week, there were angry exchanges between residents and the city's Department of Design and Construction about plans to close East River Park for at least 3 years.
Jamie, we're asking for independent, like all of the other projects. You know that. So what you're saying is not okay.
We've heard these concerns about having an independent expert. So that is the expert that works for the city.
No. Jamie, come on, really? Seriously, you know what we're talking about. The city, I don't care who, would hire a panel of experts so that would be accountable to the community. And that has been done in city projects across the city. You know what we're talking about, so please don't talk about anything else.
We've been asked about having some expertise that's under contract to the city to support the community. And then we've also heard about,
And some residents aligned with a group called the East River Alliance say the city's plan to close East River Park amounts to alienation, an illegal removal of a park from public use. And although the activists want flood protection for tens of thousands of residents, they are fearful that the city's plan is built to fail. Io Harrington, a member of the East River Alliance, had this to say.
We are saying in this case, and especially because of the track record that the city has in projects that go from 3 years to 12 years or to 25, who the heck knows, that there is no question that this is alienation, because alienation requires them to also guarantee that another similar acreage and piece of green space be made available to the public. And to have presentation after presentation and not to have answers to basic questions, like just the question about the use of the baseball field that the mother of a little leaguer asked, where are we going to be? At this point, they should know where that is. They should have been able to say here in this meeting, these are the five locations, because they've decided on five locations, right? This is getting to be very frustrating. We know we have to compromise. We know that we have to work with the city. But at this point, we are going to more direct action. Of course, we're concerned with trees and air quality and oxygen and all of the things that we need in our community. But the first thing is to maintain a community, which means keep people in their homes. And their answers to these questions are just getting more and more ridiculous and absurd to even have to listen to.
Io Harrington is a member of the East River Alliance. Another member, Naomi Schiller, is a community activist and anthropology professor. She says the city's plan to build for a 2050 sea level, increasing the height of the park by 8 feet, will not be adequate, and the park would have to be rebuilt again.
I think the idea that they're building to 2050 is laughable. That's around the corner, and we already know that the numbers that they're estimating for 2050 are inaccurate in terms of sea level rise. So in 2060, they're going to have to tear down the park and start over, or we're going to live in a city surrounded by, 20-foot walls, right? So, I think we need to think outside the idea that we can protect ourselves through walls from rising seas. We need to think about radical action to stop climate change, divest from fossil fuels. I think that's really actually what it takes.
East River Park was only recently reopened after a 3-year reconstruction stretched on to over a decade, a fact remembered by a resident who was at the meeting 6 months ago when the city demolished the community plan.
I came tonight to see if anything changed from 6 months ago, and nothing has changed. In spite of all the community meetings and taking up these issues, nothing has changed. I think they have some serious problems on resiliency on the short term. As somebody said at the very beginning, why is this limited to 2050, which is 30 years? It'll be less than that by the time they finish. It might be 20 years by the time they actually finish with it.
Michael Marino is a member of Local Community Board 3, a member of the Parks Committee. He says the city's treatment of the neighborhood has fed the opposition to rebuilding the park.
I think it's really unfortunate how things transpired, and the fact that what the community worked on with the city for 4 years was basically just tossed to the side overnight. And now this new plan is basically being pushed through somewhat at the last minute because they need to start something. Everyone wants flood protection. Everybody wants to protect the families that live along the water and protect all the buildings and the businesses that are along the water as well. But I think that what they are planning now is not the right course of action. I think that taking the community's input into account over the past 4 years was great because it provided an opportunity for the community to voice their opinions, feel like they were heard, and gave the city the buy-in that they needed from the community to move forward with the program. Now that they've just completely disregarded that and changed course overnight, of course, everybody's up in arms because we all feel disrespected. Everybody feels like there's no buy-in anymore. There's no, why did you talk to us for 4.5 years and why did we go to meeting after meeting after meeting for 4.5 years if you were just going to ignore it and do what you wanted anyway?
If the community board votes against the project, what happens?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
How about if they support it?
I think it just moves on to the next phase of probably final design and they start sort of bidding it out to contractors and whatnot. I think a lot of people, if it does move forward, I think a lot of people will continue to fight. But I think there's, from what I'm hearing from some of the people in the community, there's a little bit of exhaustion going on with people who are trying to fight this. There's a little bit of, well, it's going to happen anyway mentality starting to happen.
When are they going to start construction, do you think?
I think their plans are for fall of next year, fall of 2020.
Okay. And how long will it take, do you think, are they saying?
They're saying 3.5 years, but if you listen to anyone in the community who's been to any of the community board meetings or any of the open houses in the past, when they closed the promenade years ago to repair that, they said that was going to be a 3-year fix also, and 10 years later, the promenade finally opened. The city is estimating 3.5 years. I would say we'd be lucky as a community if the city actually gets it done in 6.
Do you think there's going to be any lawsuits or any last-ditch attempts to stop it, or is this a done deal?
The outstanding issue I think that we haven't heard a lot about is the issue of alienation. The Parks Department is allowed to close a park when it has to do with renovating the park for the good of the community. But alienation comes into play when somebody's trying to close a park for any other reason. I think some people are trying to make an argument that this falls under alienation because they're not necessarily renovating the park to make improvements to the park. They're closing the park to renovate it for climate control and for flood protection, which, again, is heavily needed and definitely needed. And I don't think anybody who's trying to fight this plan argues that they don't want the flood protection. Everybody wants the flood protection. But I think that a lot of people are wondering why we don't have a blue ribbon panel. The BQE project got a blue ribbon panel. Well, every other city project that's been somewhat contentious in the media over the past few months has been appointed a blue ribbon panel by the mayor to study the plan and to come up with the best design possible. Yet here we are on the Lower East Side, still waiting for the mayor to come in and stop this.
There seems to be some stress between people who want to protect parks and people who are afraid of their homes being flooded. There seems to be playing these two groups against each other a certain amount.
Yeah, the unfortunate outcome of this issue is that it has really created some rifts within the community and pit people against each other. They haven't been able to deal with people who don't agree with their opinion in a respectful manner. It's created some rifts in the community. I think that there's no doubt that everybody who is organized around this issue agrees that we need the flood protection. We definitely, nobody's saying don't give us flood protection. But I think the people who are more on the protecting the park side want to make sure that the way that we're getting the flood protection is the best for the community and the best for the park as well. There's been a lot of talk about other options, like decking over the FDR, and has that been looked at? Some people are like, well, can't we just go back to the old plan of all the berms and the rolling hills and deal with the construction closer to us rather than farther away from us? There's varying different opinions. And if you ask 10 people their opinion on this, you're going to get 10 different answers.
So you think that a blue ribbon commission is the way to go?
I do. I think it would help appease some members of the community to know that this project is being looked at by outside people, and it's not just people who work for the mayor's office or work for agencies under the mayor's office that are continually pushing this project for the mayor onto the community. I think that if he were to finally step up and commission a Blue Ribbon panel, I think that that would alleviate a lot of people's fears and worries.
Michael Marino is a member of Local Community Board 3. He says that the city's treatment of the neighborhood has fed the opposition to rebuilding the park. A crucial meeting on the plan is scheduled for Tuesday, June 11th at Middle School 188 at 442 East Houston Street, beginning at 6:30 p.m. Anyone who comes can speak on the plan for 2 minutes each. And the California City of Oakland passed a resolution to effectively decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms and other psychoactive plants and fungi in a unanimous city council vote last week. That makes it the second U.S. city to do so. Denver last month, where voters approved a similar ballot initiative, decriminalized magic mushrooms. Oakland's resolution is broader than Denver's. Denver's initiative decriminalized the use and possession of mushrooms containing the compound psilocybin, whereas Oakland's refers to ethnogenic plants in general, which includes the mushrooms and other plants and fungi containing psychoactive substances. Noah Potter is a psychedelic drugs activist and an attorney who helped write the Denver measure. He says he went to bed thinking the law was going down to defeat. He says the law is important because no one should be arrested for a mushroom.
I was involved throughout the process of trying to get language finalized and certified for the ballot in Denver. I did early drafts. There came a point where other people got involved who are actually in Denver and Colorado lawyers with experience in the city of Denver, and so they made some revisions. But I was involved in the early stages, certainly consulting with Kevin Matthews, the campaign director, discussing the overall orientation of the initiative and what the campaign wanted to accomplish, and talking about anticipating objections.
Why are you interested in psilocybin? I mean, I thought this was just a something people did in the park. It was just something you did as a kid for fun. Why go so far as to try and get it legalized in this way?
Baseline across the board, it's a bad law. It's a dumb law, and you should get rid of bad laws. So psychedelic prohibition under threat of severe criminal penalties is just a dumb law, and people in Denver wanted to deal with their state, Colorado's dumb law, and so I wanted to help. And in terms of why decriminalizing psilocybin mushrooms, I guess stage two of the analysis is the classification is inappropriate. First of all, the question is whether there should be a Schedule I of the Controlled Substances Act generally, and then two, why a psychedelic substance like mushrooms would be in Schedule I. So basically erroneous there. In terms of mushrooms generally, I'm a advocate for psychedelic policy reform. I went to law school with the goal of legalizing psychedelics, and this is a main life orientation of mine based on the belief that the psychedelic experience offers an unparalleled opportunity for reassessment, recalculation of priorities, and not that they are miracle cures for societal conditions, as some people seem to believe, but they offer a learning opportunity that doesn't exist anywhere else, at least possibility of on a large aggregate scale. So decriminalizing mushrooms at the local level is one of the only things that can be done to change psychedelic policy. And I should clarify, it's not legalization of psychedelics. It's removing criminal penalties for certain fairly limited acts.
Tell me a little bit more about the law, what the law that was finally passed specifically does in Denver.
There are a couple of provisions of the law. The first thing, it defines psilocybin. It defines personal possession. And personal possession is more than just possession. It means storage and propagation, cultivation of mushrooms by an adult for personal use, which is fairly significant. So it decriminalizes not just personal consumption and possession, but it also decriminalizes part of the supply side of the market, which was very important for me and Kevin Matthews, the campaign director. It declares that enforcement of laws imposing criminal penalties for personal use and possession of psilocybin mushrooms should be the lowest law enforcement priority in the city and county of Denver. It's got a bit of a punch in the next section, which prohibits any agents, employees, officers, whatever, of the city, Denver, including court employees, correctional employees, et cetera, from using any funds to assist in enforcement of laws imposing criminal penalties.
Noah Potter is an activist and attorney who helped write the Denver measure. Schedule 1 drugs are held by the DEA to have no medical purpose, and magic mushrooms have been studied for their effects in treating addiction and mental illness. And that's some of the news for Friday, June 7th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.